Hello everyone and welcome to the Green Minds podcast, a podcast dedicated to thought-provoking conversations on climate change and sustainability. My name is Eva and I am your host for this episode. Today's guest is Jana Skokan, who is the co-founder and director of Frugeeks. Frugeeks is a worldwide marketplace and offers ecological solutions for sustainable construction, green and blue infrastructure, energy, agri-tech and many other areas that enable ecological building and sustainable living on this planet. Apart from being the face of a worldwide network for sustainable building and living, Jana is also a founding member of ARC 2030. ARC 2030 is a global community for climate action that aims to inspire individuals, businesses, and communities with actionable plans to deliver a more sustainable future for our planet. I'm very happy to talk to Jana about climate smart building and living today. Welcome to the Green Minds podcast, Jana. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you very much, Eva, for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Before we jump into the topic, would you like to share with us what led you to become co-founder of Frugeeks and what Frugeeks' mission is?
Sure. So my story is actually very, very simple. I mean, I'm a girl from the mountains back in Slovakia, and I always had this connection to nature. You know, I was farming with my grandparents on the field, helping them. I was doing mountain biking a lot, like during all my, you know, teenage years until I went to university. So I was living there out in nature. So I really had this, you know, feeling like, wow, I mean, you know, you belong there. You feel like, you know, you're at home in nature. And we had really this luxury to be in a very green area. So it was amazing. And yeah, then I started my professional journey, was studying a little bit. I went abroad to Switzerland. I started in marketing and sales and communications later at a large logistics organization. And I had a super comfortable life downtown in Basel, you know, no worries, actually. Pretty well paid, you know, I mean, downtown in the city, you know, you have nothing to worry. I mean, you were in your early 20s, so life is easy. But then at some point, I became a mother. I became a mother. I think that was really like a turning point for me, like a milestone. But before, I remember I had an experience that stayed with me till today. And it's very vivid. So I went shopping. I came back home and I like to have things organized. And I was putting the you know, potatoes in one basket and tomatoes in one basket. And when I was finished with unwrapping and organizing, I realized the trash bin that I was taking out before was full of plastic covers. So there was like literally what stayed with me, like one person, one shopping. Now, if more people do this, you know, what's going to happen? So that was kind of unconscious. It stayed with me. But I don't know, 2 or 3 years later, I became a mother. I got my twins. And it really changed the perspective on things, on the future. I got very interested, you know. I took the time to be with my children only, you know, so no work on the side or no part-time. So I started to read a little bit, was very curious, and I joined some organizations. ARC 2030 was one of them, where I was happy to support the initiative once I kind of got into all the reports that are out there, or at least some, you know, they already give you some insights. So once I started to read, I really fast had this impression that, hey, we need to do something. I have 2 small kids. I need to do something. What's my role here? And I had this background in marketing and communication and sales. And I was like, okay, so, you know, during my time at home as a mom with twins, I started to be super curious about how will people live in such conditions? I mean, what can you do? I mean, you have problems with water, you will have problems with land, you have problems with air, there are extreme weather events. So how will you live in such conditions? How will my kids live? And I started to kind of connect and build a network of people working with these solutions, who are building different type of homes, who have autonomous concepts for, you know, land, water, energy systems, etc. So this became really kind of interesting, very, very colorful. And then I had this idea I had also many exchanges with the people on, you know, how is the market? How do they get along? I saw, you know, there is very slow movement on it until, you know, ecology was that time, like 5 years ago or 3 years ago, it was still very, very low profile. So it was something like, maybe somebody puts it somewhere on a marketing flyer and maybe he's ashamed of the zero behind the commitment and the pledge of 2050, because the logic is just not there. You know, the consciousness is not there. No blame, though. So we decided with my brother to, he's in construction. I mean, we have construction in the family. It's a family tradition, a profession and a tradition in our family. So he was in. I said, great, let's do it. I introduced the idea and then we said, yes, let's do it. Let's just start. And yeah, this is how we came up with the idea to build a home for sustainable building and living where people can go wild and just explore and get creative on what they can do with the property they have. And the mission is to connect them. So it's transdisciplinary. That's why we go so broad. That's why you find land there. That's why you find water there, waste or materials or, you know, furniture from weird materials that are maybe wasted or new or grown in your backyard or something. So that was the logic. And yeah, to think differently about what sustainability actually means. And that's where we kind of have our roots in. And that's the connection to nature. We on purpose do not say proper English. Many people tried to correct me, like connection with nature. No, we don't see it this way. We are part of nature. And we connect, we are connected to nature, and that's the type of buildings and properties we aspire to design and to develop.
Thank you very much for all these insights and sharing your journey with us. That was very interesting. Now I want to ask you the first question related to the topic of today's episode. So we already touched on the topics of climate smart buildings and climate smart cities. What actually is climate smart building or infrastructure? What does it mean? How would you define it? And what are the key principles and strategies for designing climate smart architecture that minimizes environmental impact and increases energy efficiency on the other side?
Now, you want to go large scale or small scale? We talk about urbanism, or you want to talk about individual property?
I think we can start with large scale.
Great. So, yeah, when we talk about climate smart architecture or design or planning or urban design, then for us, I mean, I say always us because it's a community of people and, you know, so it's not only my ideas, but it's the inner connection that is kind of driving all these ideas and inspiring us. And it's really going away from this reductionist view of energy efficiency is based on if you have solar panels only. So that's not enough for us. It's good. It's an element. It's part of the solution, but it's certainly not the base. It's not the foundation, and it's not where you get the biggest leverage. You can add it on. So now I would go into the elements of what climate smart architecture or design or planning, urban planning is for us. So certainly you start with nature-based design. So it's absolutely, you know, you come to a location. I mean, if we would have the opportunity to do it from the scratch, like maybe they do it now in Saudi Arabia at NEOM, where they do also very interesting stuff. Now we can discuss a lot about, you know, what is sustainable, what is very visionary and less sustainable, and what is like, let's push technology off and show what it can do, you know? So there is also a difference on that, but nature-based design, looking at the location, looking at the resources which you have, of course, understanding the risks which you have, also with progressive climate change, that is the base. That, I mean, I would not do now a planning if I don't know what is the zoning, what is the flood rate over here, what is like the temperature increases that are projected in this area. We know Europe is heating more than other regions. So actually, you know, we should be looking at some kind of elements like this. Resources and risk, nature-based design according to that. Yeah, we will talk maybe about coastal areas. So, you know, it's quite clear that you need to prepare for that as well. Once you have this and you understand where do you get also the base for living in the development that you plan or design, which is water, land, food, how do you want to do this? Energy, of course, and optimize it for the conditions. Then you can go into the deeper structure of green blue infrastructure that is, of course, nurturing biodiversity. So that would be like a second element, second layer of that. It's a little bit like a mountain, you know, you go up. A third thing would be materials. What type of materials would you choose? Of course, we look at LCA-based, durable, local, if possible. Of course, better, less transport, less emissions. You have something that you can replace. You can rebuild it potentially if it's needed. So such type of materials, of course, if they can also lock some carbon, that's great. If you don't produce too much embodied carbon with producing the material, also great. So that LCA will tell you for sure. And urban metabolism, that would be something that I would love to have in check, which is not the case. I have not heard about that. So urban metabolism are the inputs and outputs of a city and put it in a balance. So waste, water, energy, transport, everything. We have this, you know, smart technology, a lot of sensors, a lot of possibilities that we have with data collection, of course, limited by some constraints. Maybe we will get to that. But certainly you can measure a lot of things on how our resources flow. What is their quality? What is their components? And where do they go? Where do they come from? How you can maybe leverage them better, optimize the flows, and put it also in the context of the carrying capacity of Earth. So this is what we are missing in our planning. We believe, you know, we're going to continue to discharge wastewater in the amounts that we do on the frequency that we do, and nothing is going to happen. It's going to be great for the next 20 years. So this is putting it in the context of carrying capacity, having this systemic thinking or systems thinking on how Earth operates, what are the natural processes, how much does it take to regenerate for water quality on a natural, in a natural process. And of course, I use it also for building circularity loops and autonomy. Autonomy is what we see really as an interesting element, being autonomous in energy. You see that everywhere. It's decentralized energy, it's decentralized food, it's decentralized water treatment. Everybody should be able to operate on their own, share, connect, exchange, but be able to also operate on their own if it's desired or relevant. And then the next layer would be certainly sensors. So I see the usage of technology as a kind of, yeah, it's less than the base. I would not base all the concepts, you know, on technology, because you have just the dependency on energy and everything else. So it has to be kind of, for me, a cherry on the top, or, you know, something additional. And these sensors can help us very nicely with urban metabolism, with materials, with monitoring the health of the green and blue infrastructure, and also the effectiveness of this nature-based design. So it can be very interesting how we can leverage that. And of course, the data which they provide or deliver to us, we can use it nicely for early warning systems, for maintenance, you know, such type of intelligence that we can leverage for so many things, and also add value to the people, to the inhabitants of the place, of the space, of the region. And the last but not least, it would be also shared situational awareness. So safety and immediate response for extreme weather events. This is also what we kind of, you know, after the Cold War, it was a kind of, you know, relief time, where I'm not quite sure if there's so much invested into the protection and security of citizens and cities to have shelter, to have a plan, to have clear communication lines and functioning systems that provide shared awareness on a situation when it comes up, once it comes up, and people can act in a coordinated way.
Thank you very much. And you talked a lot about the importance of data-driven solutions and technology when building these climate smart cities. Do you see any challenges with that, apart from the technological side, regarding the rights of citizens and data security? Or is that not a problem that you have to consider when thinking of the building and infrastructure process?
Yes, it's the essential thing. It's the essential thing to be able to protect the rights for privacy, for autonomous decisions, for having control over your data. And of course, if you agree to use them for a certain application, to let them be used for a certain application, then there should be massive value added to you as a citizen providing this data. So, but there is also a difference, because we can add water sensors or water quality sensors on individual level on every flat, or we can do it on the major channels, where, you know, all people are contributing. You can identify the building, you can identify the company which is discharging certain elements or toxins or whatever. And there is a very clear process or procedures to manage, to control, to mitigate, to remedy for if there are any events, whether it's an accident or whatever. You know, so this is a different level, and we do not need to go to the individual surveillance level. We do not need to do this straight away. We can use it. I'm not personally a super friend of surveillance and, you know, going more or utilizing data or smart technology only for this or primarily for this. Security is for me also defined as the exposure to the conditions which we know are changing and we know we need to protect, whether it's, you know, I mean, there is so much statistics on the water quality. We know that there is so much damage done with pharma, with fertilizers, you know, we have then all the waste. And how are we going to manage this element of security using the data that we have and use it in a wise manner to protect people? So privacy, of course, absolutely, yes, autonomous, encrypted, access, controlled, transparent, and it has to add value. It has to be for people like, wow, I mean, I'm going to do this because this is going to change my life, but it really should also offer the opportunity to kind of have, you know, ways how to manage that, because it's never the case that you have 100%. It's never the case. And you should allow also for, you know, for this room or consider that in the planning.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any examples of existing cases where countries or cities incorporate technological solutions or data-driven solutions in their building or city infrastructure? Do you see examples that already exist?
I mean, there are some, for sure. I mean, recently, several cities. Now, I do not have them on the top of my mind, but if you like put it in a quick search, I believe you're going to find like 3-4 cities at least that utilize sensors and mobility monitoring for traffic control. You know, that's like congestion control. That's like the first thing, air quality. But it's, again, only one part of the thing. Now, I talk about technology, but for me, technology is secondary. To all my friends with technology solutions, I'm sorry, but it's secondary. Nature is always first. And this is what we saw as well in terms of results. So we had a project developed for Sofia, Bulgari, for some of those that know, you know, this country or the city or have been there. They have a big problem with parking, with congestion and, you know, air, noise, traffic, time, money. You have all these problems. So, and health, of course, health. So we were looking at the project, how to work with that. And of course, smart parking is one way to do it. You have then, you know, dynamic pricing, you can control the traffic, you can reroute, you have different parking spots. So this is what you can do, but you're missing the essential piece because it can only do so much if you still have all gray and the infrastructure is still accumulating, for example, the sun exposure or the sun energy all the time, the thermal energy all the time, then it's going to anyhow not mitigate or reduce the temperature. It's not going to really change dramatically the air quality because you are not looking for the additional elements, which is if you want to have smart parking, maybe you can define some spaces where you can create small green areas. You can give up like 6 parking lots and you can create a small urban forest that does something totally different for the area, for air quality, for the temperature, and also for the traffic, and also for the benefit of the people, because it's a different life quality when you come into a car that is not overheated and you don't need to spend like another 15 minutes to kind of cool it down so you can get your kid inside or something. And this can be included in the charges that are for parking. Of course, we have all these dynamic elements then, but you can also then play with slowing down the traffic. How do you do this? You have, of course, maybe another, you know, cycling path. You have maybe some trees put in. You have maybe some active mobility options or alternatives for people to combine the routing and to make it also accessible for everybody to still kind of fulfill the need of, you know, transport, come from one point to the other. But I like more this concept when you go from smart parking will solve it for us to, okay, this has actually the potential to deliver this and this co-benefit if we are able to expand the horizon and work with the other elements as well. And yes, Sofia, Barcelona does great things. I think they implemented now the water management measures because they have large problems with water now in Spain. And I mean, Catalonia was declaring a water emergency early in February. So it's very early in the season, but you have to get ready for that. And yeah, so they will now control or measure and make it mandatory for all new buildings to reuse shower water that you use for toilet flushing, which is, come on, it's just common sense. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's nothing like, you know, let's fly to Mars and develop, I don't know, what kind of technology. It's just another pipe in the system that you know how to combine it. Maybe you need to invest with new buildings. It's very simple because you can plan and design with it from the beginning.
Thank you. Yeah, I think circular economy is a big topic and efficient planning and reusing resources is very important. You touched on the topic of nature-based solutions and said that this is your priority, or you would prioritize nature-based solutions to technology-driven solutions. What would you say, are there any challenges or downside of integrating nature-based solutions in cities? Like, for example, animals that come back to the cities, or do you have any examples, anything on that?
This is a great point. I love it because, you know, the ultimate proof of all the pledges on sustainability will be to see that come back and to survive, tolerate this exchange, you know. When you have a bug, when you go barefoot on the grass, that's if you have a problem with going barefoot, tip for all the listeners, you are disconnected from nature. Try to do that more often. And it's a thing for sure. But we are evolving, we are learning, and we also do not have all the answers. I do not have them. My colleagues don't have them. So we will need to kind of relearn some stuff for sure as well. And when you talk about the downsides of having more nature back in the city, I would say we should consider for sure maintenance cost, etc. So, you know, there will be leaves falling if you have trees around. There will be some birds singing in the morning, maybe at 5 or 6 a.m., which many people hate. I can confirm that. So these are the things that we kind of, however, still, I believe, need to educate people on the value of. So it has a value. It has a function. Every bird, every bug has a function. If you have really a very anxious relation to maybe bugs and you have a green wall or something, which is a kind of, you know, you need to consider that. I mean, it's let's be transparent. Let's do not say, I mean, there are no living animals. If you want to help diversity, I mean, you will be glad if you have some, you know, animals there, whether it's bugs or whatever, butterflies or whatever, it will be your bees. So maybe nets on the windows are an option, you know, just kind of leaving the space for everybody, respecting the space for them, letting them have their space, respecting that, and creating this transition or buffer zone for us to have the exchange if desired. There are people which enjoy the company of animals. You have so many health benefits for children, you know, they love to observe, they love to study, and this is what they need. I mean, you will not study it from, you know, from the computer. It's a different thing. I love it. I love the digital space, but it's a different thing. So I would say, yeah, it's maintenance. It's really this exposure, planning in some kind of transition buffer zones that enable enough space for both, for human, for people that like the exchange, but also for the animals that we need to fulfill and to provide, to continue to provide to us the ecosystem services, which we take for free from them. This is a little bit the missing piece in people's mind, because they think, you know, it's just making my window dirty and that's it. And I need to clean it. I need to spend water and stuff. But the person does not see what is the pollination element, etc.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the topic of raising awareness and educating people who live in these cities, how important climate smart infrastructure is and what benefits climate smart city building can have. What would you say, what are other benefits on those citizens or people living in climate smart cities, apart from the reduction of emissions or cooler places, for example? Are there also opportunities of new jobs or new ways of engaging in the city?
Yes. I mean, so the estimates are like also quite overwhelming when you look at the green economy, like maybe the real economy, but something where we really look at beyond ESG pledges and create this down to earth. This is what needs to be done. This is where we need to control this. This is where we need to plant this. This is where we need to maintain plants, trees, feed animals, I don't know, build something, develop something, then it's actually quite impressive how many jobs can be created now. I do not have the exact number. There was a very interesting talk from one of my favorite futurists, Gert Leonhardt. If some of you follow him or would like to leverage that, he has very interesting talks, and certainly there is a lot on the green economy as well. So it was in multiple ways exceeding what is being now provided by the oil and gas industry right now. So this is something to bear in mind. That was very interesting, and it was multiple times more. It was like maybe 5-10x. So that's something to look forward to. And you see that, I mean, with the rise of social media, nobody was thinking about the social media manager or, you know, copywriter or something as a serious job. Now you have people that are high paid professionals sought after that can do this job very well. So I can imagine that. I mean, you see natural capital managers now being more in demand. You see, so this is something that certainly helps to create economic opportunity without any doubt. We are yet to discover all the options because there is a lot more to be done, to understood, to be cared for, to be maintained for. So certainly, you mentioned emissions, right? You mentioned cooler buildings, right? You have lower cost. You know, if you can translate it, a municipality could translate it into lower cost for everybody. You know, if you just treat your water right, everybody does their job, they do it within the standard, then everybody is going to pay less for waste, for chemical treatment. You know, you have all the reports. So it's a big benefit. I mean, we have this forever chemicals that are circulating most probably in all our blood. Let's be honest, if the European Parliament members were tested positive on forever chemicals, I believe, you know, they have a high standard of living. A lot of people suffer from that. And the impact of this contamination in human bodies is yet to be known, is yet to be understood, same as with plastics. So health is a big thing. We know very little about what we have been doing and what's the impact on us. We see rise of many sicknesses, many problems. There are already some studies that have some kind of relation, have some kind of perspective on that. So they signal already some first information on that. But we need to research more. We need to understand more what we are doing and tailor our actions accordingly with the mind of having a healthy population at some point of time and, you know, being able to maintain that. And so health, economic benefits, whether it's jobs, it's saving for the community. And you have also the economic opportunity of when you have nature-based solutions, it's actually, I'm not quite sure if you observed it, but I noticed it quite heavily. People tend to, in a sunny weather or, you know, when there is an opportunity to enjoy a landscape, they tend to accumulate there. They tend to meet there. They tend to celebrate there. They tend to enjoy their time over there, their life over there, to learn, gather, I don't know, create art, do sports. So it is actually an opportunity when you see Amsterdam, the streets that they converted from pure traffic streets where there was high intensive traffic to pedestrian zones. There were so many thriving restaurants, etc. So it's actually vice versa. You know, you create these opportunities for people to gather, to meet. There is a shop, there is a coffee shop, there is maybe some place for children to play, etc. And these are the things that then create the vibe, quality of life as well for the people. And this, I mean, we are social beings. We need to kind of gather, we need to exchange. That's what we love. And that creates the spaces. So I would see the economic benefit also in this matter. And there are also studies that confirm reduced criminality in spaces where there is intentionally well planned and thoroughly positioned, strategically positioned greenery. So, you know, you have the examples of fast built in dense environment, dense built areas where there is no green. It's like, you know, if you want to build there, sometimes you don't know if it's a plus or a minus to be there, you know, because it's such an area that you may think lower quality. And that brings me to another element. You see also the value of properties being determined by the value and the quality of greenery that you have around the place. So more greenery, higher quality, well-maintained, 30% more of property value. So why not? You know, it has so many benefits that, I mean, recently I saw a post on somebody that there was a residential property. There were like 2-3 buildings and they cut down all the trees that they had there. Now, the logic is open. I don't know the person personally from the city or something. So the argumentation, I mean, you know, you never know if they mitigate or compensate with another space. So I was not going more into the details, but it looks like a ghetto, you know. I mean, everything gray, nothing maintained. The if I would sell a home or buy a house over there, I would look at the property at the neighborhood, and potentially I would be less likely to pay more for such a property.
Yeah, that's interesting. So sustainable cities not only create jobs and social inclusion, reduce criminality, but also make properties more valuable, maybe. Another topic I want to talk to you about is the role of policies and the role of governance in creating sustainable and smart cities. What do you think, what policies are essential to support the growth of sustainable buildings and smart cities on a global scale?
That's a massive role. It has a massive role. We cannot go without you. Yes. I mean, absolutely. No, so how to put it? For sure, it's a team sport. It's a team game. So important is to decide we want to do this. Yes, this makes sense. We have so much overwhelming statistics, so much. It's just so much. And then you have also so many ways you can do it. So important is what we see from the exchanges that we have to support the municipality on in terms of understanding what is the priorities for the region, for the city. If for sure they carry, that's their burden, that's their job, that's their responsibility to take care of the people that live there. So first one is risk. What are the risks? What are the risks of the region? What do you need? I mean, we had Germany, you know, 2 years ago or something, there was also the flooding. You can discuss, you can, you know, have many perspectives on that, which is okay. That's what we should do. And we should act upon what we know is maybe not so positive, you know? So if we have a certain indication, if we have certain signals, we should be able to take the right steps into the right direction and do it in a consistent way, because it's just what the job comes with, you know. I mean, you would not be in a municipality if you don't care about the people that live in the city. It doesn't make sense. You would move to another city or something, I don't know. So I would start with there, look at the risk, and I would like to also bring this closer to the people. Start with the risks. If you know there is a risk, there is a risk assessment for the country, for the region. They already know where the problems are, where the risks are. We have this data for so long, and it's just getting better with all this geo-analytics and what you have. So you have very interesting possibilities. Now, once you know this, you need to have the hard discussion not how you're going to do it. Because if you need to do it, it's just there is no discussion. There are these people, there are the risk. It's your job. You need to do it. That's what you came for. That's how I would see it. When, as soon as possible, it's like with any other sickness, you know? You know there is a sickness. The longer you prolong it, the worse the treatment will be. The less effective will it be. You know, the lower your chances are to survive. So you rather step up the hard discussions, do what the doctor tells you to do, and, you know, try your best to get healthy again. So you have this hard discussion, how you're going to do it. And then eventually you create a plan, a roadmap. I definitely advise. And there are many, you know, urban planning agencies that work with ecologists, system thinkers that really understand the logic of, you know, we have a problem with water. There are many elements we can do in the city with the water management, with the industry. But there is also an element on protection of the riparian forest, for example. How do we invest into nature-based solutions that go beyond the borders of our city? How do we cooperate maybe with other regions? Because you have this impact that cascades then further to your place. You know, if there is a river that has a origin somewhere in the mountains and the mountains are cut clear, what do you expect? If there is no forest, there is no, you know, water production source. So that's the element that You need to understand this and then be able to start the collaboration to also kind of have a broad radius and have this systemic thinking, because working in isolation will not solve the things. You will just not have such an impact. So this, and then break it down. I mean, there are sometimes discussions that we have, like, what are the requirements for companies to be in the area? You know, so it's always a double coin. I also understand, you know, there is a certain investment. There are economic opportunities that come with a certain company moving into the area, bringing jobs to the region, for example. But they also need to recognize that they utilize the resources from over there. So, you know, it has to be a fair exchange of resources that are taken, resources that are used, and also what do they bring back. And you do not need to penalize them. Only, of course, you can. It's a very regular instrument. You have to have some standards. You have to keep them. Otherwise, you know, I mean, if you just put toxic elements into water, I mean, and you discharge them, if you monitor that, I mean, sorry, this is not how we do things. You know, you cannot do this. But there are also many incentives how you can help companies to make this happen, because nobody wants to kind of poison, you know, land or people. Nobody wants to do this. Is really looking for the economic trigger and being able to convert it into the opportunity. But I believe that that can be done.
One other topic I want to talk to you about is the line. I think you already mentioned it in the beginning when you talked about Saudi Arabia. So for our listeners, the line is a linear smart city under construction in Saudi Arabia, which is designed to have no cars and no streets or carbon emissions. And it's under construction since October 2022. And now, what do you think about the line and this project? And do you think it's realistic to build a city or a line in Saudi Arabia which aims to reduce emissions or have no cars, no streets, and be completely sustainable? What do you think about this whole idea, and how realistic is it?
I mean, it's a vision. Line is a vision. And Neom itself, because Line is one of the districts, no, it's one of the regions of Neom. Neom is the big project. So the Saudi Arabia is having to kind of move away from oil producing country to a tourism magnet. They want to show what's possible in city planning, maybe in art and tourism or culture. And according to what I understood, they want to do it even more than what we see right now in Dubai, which is very impressive. I mean, you can also discuss a lot about Dubai, and there is also a lot of things that are being planned there. The Agenda 2030 by the leadership over there is also very interesting. They do have a lot of sustainability elements as well. So for me, it's certainly a vision. And one thing on the line that kind of triggered my attention is, yeah, I would compare it to Trojena. Trojena is another district from the Neom concept or project. And it's the ski resort in the desert, 2,600 meters in the middle of the desert, which is actually a relatively good altitude. I mean, it could be, you know, it could be lower. So they have naturally some snow there, not too much, but they have it. The temperatures would allow for that. And actually they have it on a not so frequent, not in such volumes as in the Swiss Alps, maybe they had. Not so much now as they were before, but anyhow, they still have a lot of snow, but still there is the natural conditions to have a cooler temperature and to have some snow over there. This is the kind of interesting thing. But when we put Trojena and the line next to each other, the line is, I mean, first of all, there is very little details really shared on the sustainability, how it's going to be achieved. I mean, it's what, like 170 kilometers in the desert. They build it like in 80 kilometers blocks or something. So, or maybe a little bit longer, but yeah, I'm not sure now exactly. But yeah, I would love to see the details on the embodied carbon, on the materials. It's mirrored from both sides to kind of blend into the environment. Very interesting. I mean, you have a lot of concepts on this tiny and narrow building, etc., to maximize, you know, to build in height, not to build on the landscape, which is interesting. I would just like to understand the thermodynamic principles that they work with. And if you have this heat exchange and energy exchange, I mean, how do they want to collect the energy? How do they want to manage water over there? Because it's going to be highly populated. And of course, you miss the nature. So, I mean, there, if I understood correctly, there is also a very interesting project planned in Dubai, which should be like a tunnel through the city, which is a kind of botanical garden where you can shop and eat and, you know, do some sports or something. And it's also fully covered, but it's with plants. So as far as I have seen the renderings of the line, it's very little plants there. For me, as a, I mean, I have a professional, you know, professional mark on me already that if I enter a space and there are no plants, I feel like, you know, this is missing something. It's like too little green. There has to be a plant. You know, we need to do something here. But there was very little of this. There is all artificial light. You know, it's like very nicely rendered, but there must be some artificial light as well. Maybe they have the some sky tunnels or, you know, the skylights. So more details for me, for sure. It's very visionary, but what we have seen from such visions is sometimes they become a reality. And sometimes they really prove we can do things. And sometimes we also need to test. Unfortunately, we need to also test to learn sometimes. So yeah, for me, it would be important to see how sustainable is it really? What are the materials? What is the LCA behind of the materials? And of the materials, of the concept, of the energy demand, and water, food, how is it going to be this provided for so many people? I mean, it should be like a state, no? It's like for millions of people planned. So, I mean, at least over here in Switzerland, we have from 8 to 9 million somewhere in between right now. So how will you provide for this in a sustainable manner starting right now? Until, you know, what's the durability? I mean, you have mirrors on the wall. So are there special, you know, what type of material is that? Is it with solar foil? Is it going to be reflected? Or, you know, what is the story behind it? I believe maybe they cannot also share all the details, but critical thinking and kind of questioning the beautiful cover behind that, I think that's what we need to learn, because it's a lot of can be said, but having people also on the project that are deep in ecology and that can guarantee there are some principles respected if they want to sell it this way. If they want to build something that is beautiful, artistic, and it's an amazing, mind-blowing design that costs a lot of financial resources and is very resource intensive, it's also an approach. I mean, you know, in the end, it's a decision, but it's important also to be transparent on that. And then do not promote it as this is the way to build and this is what we can do. And actually you see then you don't see the background. So for me, it's more transparency, more information on the concept and sustainability. I have not seen too much on that. But when I compare it just like briefly to Trojena, what I liked about Trojena is it evokes a little bit this Petra feeling because it's in stone. If you see, it's still man-made. It's artificial living space created or built on the mountain, but it looks like caves or something. Not really super modern, super luxurious. So please don't quote me on that, like caves, but caved in living space in stone, and it has green covers on that. So that's the green roofs. That's the, you know, things that kind of are interesting. Of course, then you still come up or end with the same topic. What's the water? I mean, they will, as for what I have read, they will desalinate and pipe it up there, which is an option. I mean, you can discuss with sustainability. It's always, how far do you want to go? Because desalination has its pros and cons as well. Sorry. So you see, I'm getting very passionate about it.
Yeah, thank you very much for sharing all these informations and your thoughts with us. One final or last question to you. What do you see, or what would you say, what's the future outlook for sustainable cities and climate smart cities and building? What are the trends and what should we focus on, or what are the solutions of the future?
Based on what we know and what world we live in, which is reading the data, seeing the predictions and adjusting the designs according to that, and preparing for that, and The goal would be to mitigate first, to do the basics right, stop what is really harmful, don't do it, and adapt as much as you can. That's our approach. So coming from that perspective, I definitely see future trends of buildings as nature-connected spaces, integrated spaces, where it's really a life quality. I mean, when you want to see some kind of model like this, ecological villages may be also an element. You can have more. You can still have this mega city, but a little bit more like a village style, you know, more green, more decentralized, broader connected, infrastructure integrated, so, or mobility integrated as well. So why not to do it this way? And people have their room, their space, what they need to socialize and to cover their needs. And autonomous, I mean, for us, it's a big trigger to make sure that the developments harvest what they need, water, you know, rain, utilize it, have some gardens, vertical gardens, community gardens. I mean, you have also pros and cons and also applications. And it's not one key for all the doors. It's not one solution for all. So always also think about the local design, local conditions, local ecotype. And passive solar, when we talk about energy efficiency, low tech. First of all, low tech. Why would you invest into some kind of, you know, generators and ventilators if you can do 80% better than what is the average of the best what is done right now if you just turn the house differently and have different positioning of windows and you have some shading over there? So this would be the types of things that, yeah, we would do first of all, and then and complement and adjust and monitor and see and optimize.
Perfect. Thank you so much for your time and all the interesting insights and information you shared with us today. I really enjoyed talking to you about the current state of climate smart cities with all its opportunities and challenges. Thank you also for giving insights into the work of FruGeeks and your personal journey. If this episode has piqued your interest and you have more questions, check out the website of FruGeeks. And to everyone listening, I hope you've enjoyed this episode with Jana Skokan. If you'd like to hear more insights, don't forget to subscribe to the Imperial Business Podcast. And if you have any suggestions or know the perfect guest for us to interview, please drop us a message at podcast.greenminds@gmail.com. Thank you for listening and see you soon.